Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi, and thank you for your interest in health topics and for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. This week, the topic is digital health, both physical and mental. Now, there are an awful lot of digital devices we can use aimed at helping with our physical and mental health. We look at how useful they can be, but there is absolutely one thing without any doubt at all.
And we're talking largely consumer devices. So the kind of Fitbits, the step counting, the watches, the Apple watches, the Strava, the Garmin, those types of things is like a $24 billion global annual industry.
This is big business we're talking about. So please join me for a delve into the digital health economy with Dr. Rachel Kent. And stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. My guest, Dr. Rachel Kent, is a lecturer in the digital economy at King's College London. She's founder of Doctor Digital Health, and really she's interested in all things digital and how they affect our physical and mental health. My first question was if I had summed up her interests properly.
Yes, you've summed it up perfectly. That's absolutely right. Largely I've been looking at for about 17 years now the relationship between bodies and technology, and particularly how tech impacts our mental and physical health through lots of different apps and platforms, and of course how the digital world has changed in that time.
Yeah, well, it's changing daily, really, isn't it?
Indeed it is, yeah.
So you know you can't sit on your laurels. Presumably you've got to keep reading the literature because there's always something new to find out about in your chosen
field.
Luckily
that is my day job. So fortunately that goes hand in hand, and I'm ever intrigued with the latest literature. And I think at the moment I'm very interested in TikTok and the algorithm and the potential addictive nature of it, or the way in which it kind of pulls us in. But my background is largely, I've looked a lot at health apps and wearables and how that shapes our health choices.
Okay, because my thought was to concentrate sort of on wearables, and I suppose to some extent the apps that the wearables talk to, that mm-hmm. kind of thing, as opposed to the whole world of social media, which is, that'll be another series probably of...
I'll come back for another episode on that.
Yes, that might be the thing to do. But for today, I want to concentrate on wearables, because it seems that wearables can measure pretty much everything. You know, how well we sleep, how many paces we take, what we eat, what our heart rate is, what our blood pressure is, some of them. I'm not sure how mm-hmm. accurate that is. And I see a lot of people just, this is kind of, when I'm out and about, a lot of people seem to wear them and use them. But have you got an idea of just how many people do kind of interact with these things?
So I don't have exact figures. All I can say is that the value of the global kind of economy around digital health, and we're talking largely consumer devices, so the kind of Fitbits, the step counting, the watches, the Apple watches, the Strava, the Garmin, those types of things, is like a $24 billion global annual industry. So if we think about how that equates to users, it's absolutely huge and growing all the time. And I think what's really interesting is...
Just say that statistic again. So what did you
25
say?
Billion annually.
Oh my goodness. Okay, right.
Yeah, dollars.
I had absolutely no idea it was something like that. And that brings in a whole new level of things. It's not just about people being interested in their health. It's about people being sold to as well, which is
absolutely
a whole other dimension.
It's a whole other dimension, but you could argue the two are coming ever closer together, and I guess we'll get into that part of the conversation.
Yeah, goodness me. All right, so what are people interested in? What does your average Joe who's got one of these things measure?
So I would say the most common type of wearable, and it's also known as self-tracking, is step counting. you know, the golden 10,000 steps a day is that golden number, which, just as a kind of side note, was created by an insurance company arbitrarily. It's not rooted in any kind of scientific rationality. And they got picked up, very interestingly, by all the tech companies that wanted to develop these types of wearables and self-tracking as the golden number that we should all aspire to. And in fact, there are studies that have come out of Harvard since the 10,000 steps a day thing has so become so ubiquitous and pervasive around the world for many of us to kind of benchmark our physical activity. Actually, it's far lower. There are studies coming out of Harvard that it's about between 4,000 and 5,000 steps a day. Now, I don't want to discourage or dissuade anybody from doing their 10,000 steps a day, but I think it's just interesting because it is an arbitrary figure that's kind of been pulled out. And, sure. And that is the one that often many of us benchmark how we perceive physical health today in today's society.
Okay, well, the power of marketing.
Indeed.
A thing that I find interesting, and actually is, I heard it on the news on the school run this morning, you know, worried about everybody's getting fatter, less healthy, life expectancy is going down. Yet at the same time, from what you just said, it appears we're spending more money on these kind of trackers. So do these trackers actually help us keep healthier and fitter, or are they just a bit of a toy?
It's such a good question, and I don't have a straightforward answer, but the key motivation and driver for why we now, as members of a digital society, how I kind of look at it through from my research, is we desire to quantify health. It helps us understand, or perceivably understand, how we can prevent future kind of pathologies or future illness or disease. It is all about health, is all now about, on the consumer level, the individual level, prevention through utilizing all these different tools that can, as you mentioned at the beginning, monitor all these different facets and aspects of our body. And so we are intrigued at externalizing the interior of what's going on and getting that visual representation of our steps or our blood pressure or our glucose is obviously the latest one. And that can be really motivating. That can encourage certain behaviors. That can be holding us accountable to certain activity. Again, the 10K steps thing is something that in my own work, my participants have spoken about. If they haven't reached it, they'll walk around the block a few times before they go to bed to get their 10K, or around the house, depending on if they're living in a block of flats or whatever. So it does really have a direct correlation between activity and pushing people to respond. However, there is a wealth of research, including my own, which signals the problems with health tracking in the reductive nature of it and the inability to really capture, of course, somebody's whole body and health, and actually causes a huge amount of stress and anxiety. And so, as you say, the kind of wider context of public health decreasing in terms of population health, you know, clearly, even though the government are pushing us to use these tools because it's cheaper for them, and they have been doing so since 2008, right, since the global recession and those austerity measures, is that translating into increasing public health? And it's not, as you say.
Okay. Interesting what you say there about if people haven't done their 10,000 steps or whatever, or they don't, for whatever reason, feel they're as fit as they should be, at least a kind of a mental health problem of, oh my God, I'm not fit enough.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the mental anxiety and stress, and I write a lot about this in my book, is the kind of guilt and shame that we ascribe or link to our inability to capture these certain activities. You know, if we're not able to reach our 10,000 steps a day, or if we're not able to go running and log it, or we're not able to reach a certain calorie deficit if we're tracking, you know, calories and our diet, that generates a huge amount of stress and anxiety for those that really might not need to be worried about their health, this kind of rise of the worried well.
One of the questions I had, and I sort of, you've touched on it there, and it's probably impossible, you know, does looking at the info from these things either inspire us to do more or just make us upset that we haven't done enough? And I suppose the answer is it's going to be different for everyone, and possibly no one really knows. I don't know.
Different for everybody. And I guess my advice to my clients and whoever I'm speaking to about this is very much that if you are doing something that a device is nudging you to do, and we call it choice architecture. So we're nudged to do certain behaviors, is the kind of behavioral economics of how they're designed, and push or foreclose certain health outcomes. If you are doing something that the device is telling you to do that you physically don't feel able to do, either you've got an injury, or maybe you're tired, or you're grieving, or you're stressed, whatever it might be, or you're undereaten, overeaten, underslept, overslept, all of these things, don't do it. And it's the following the guidance of an application over the instinct of the body. That's when the problems arise in terms of the impact, particularly on mental health, but also physical health. You know, if you're running on an injury, for example, when you shouldn't be, or if you're running and you haven't eaten enough, that could be dangerous.
Goodness me. I sometimes get the feeling that the human race is dividing into two. You've got the fitties. And sometimes I call them the fatties. I probably shouldn't, but the non-fitties. You know, we're like diverging into two separate species.
Almost. Two camps.
Yeah. And yeah. So do you think that these kind of things, what sections of society use these things? And do you think, you know, that actually, is it a bit unhealthy? Because you've got those people that do use them and monitor everything, and those that, you know, just can't be bothered. And actually, these things can be quite expensive as well. Not everyone can access them.
Absolutely. There is the socioeconomic digital divide. And I was actually recently, I had the Ada Lovelace Institute on my podcast, who were saying that the first thing that people are giving up in the cost of living crisis is their Wi-Fi. That's the first thing that people who are very much living in, you know, on the breadline and are currently struggling. And so that's indicative, right, that there is a huge, and that was kind of surprising to me. I was like, God, with the Wi-Fi, let alone all these kind of extra devices that cost a huge amount on top of that. It's not segmented. It's so intergenerational. There are so many different demographics of users. And I think what I see now, living in London, traveling around on the tube regularly, is every generation having particularly step counters or some kind of wearable tracker. And it's not necessarily confined to those that are overweight or unhealthy in whatever way we're kind of quantifying that, or those that are particularly fit and healthy. It really is the everyday person now who can afford it, who is got access to Wi-Fi, who can afford a data package, who can afford the device themselves. Whether it correlates to better health outcomes is a whole other debate. And I think overall, I'm not sure that it does. But it's not confined to a certain generational demographic in the way that when they first boomed in early 2010, when they first hit the consumer market on that big global scale, they were very much confined to white men, middle class, very kind of tight little bracket of users.
Yeah. Slightly techie kind of blokes.
Techie, kind of nerdy, like really interested in kind of the latest developments on the tech and body kind of front. We actually came from a group of individuals called the Quantified Self. So it was Gary Wolf and Kevin Kelly, who were the co-editors of Wired magazine at the time in San Francisco. Right. And they set up this Quantified Self movement, which then boomed around the globe. And they were the first to really make all of these devices, which we now know as wearables. And that was in 2007. You see the consumer rise in 2010.
I'll have to invite you back on in 10 years' time for a sort of a definitive answer to whether it works. But something that it might be easier to get an answer to a bit more quickly. Some of these wearables can be linked directly to doctors, to GPs, or private doctors as well, and that, you know, they can help with diabetes and alert kind of the whole medical world. And I guess the result is someone gets a call and says, you know, have you noticed this? You seem to have a blip on your blood sugar or whatever, that sort of idea.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of up and running and useful? And can you see that as a way ahead and being actually quite useful for the NHS, maybe saving lots of money and making it a lot more efficient?
Definitely. And I think COVID really normalized digital healthcare pathways being rolled out on a large, you know, population health scale that we didn't see before. And I think what's interesting, I've done some work with the NHS on what we now know as the digitally engaged patient. And again, that wasn't, we thought like the older generation would be resistant to like even video consultations, let alone kind of monitoring all these things about their bodies from the home. But actually there was a huge uptake and there's a huge spike. And that's so beneficial for a healthcare system to be able to remotely monitor, self-autonomously manage it from the patient perspective. There are ethical debates and considerations around it in terms of reliability and the responsibilization of the patient. You know, if it's not your clinician monitoring it and it's you monitoring it, that places a huge amount of individual responsibility on that patient, which ethically you could say for certain individuals might cause or create additional pressures or anxieties that they may not be capable of managing, or it may just be too much to handle. But I think, yeah, there are huge opportunities for particularly AI and remote monitoring in public healthcare, definitely.
So how much of that is happening actually now? The way you answered that question, I got the impression actually it's happening quite a bit now, and I didn't really realise that.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, with regards to kind of remote monitoring, and when I say digital healthcare, I also mean just like video consultations, things like that, but remote monitoring is already happening. I think with regards to like AI and its ability to diagnose pattern recognition in terms of disease prevention and huge amounts of data, that is already happening in the NHS. There are issues with the reliability of it. Again, you always will need that human intervention, that human oversight. And the same thing goes for remote monitoring. You might be able to remote monitor certain issues or blood glucose, let's come back to kind of diabetes or blood glucose again, but you will always need to have a clinician overseeing that and checking it. But I think what's really interesting now is the uptake in these devices that were once reserved for medicine, like blood glucose trackers, that are now being commercially available, like the Zoe app, which has had a huge surge in uptake from consumers. And it's, yeah, very interesting how these
That is really pushed a lot as well, isn't it? That particular thing you just mentioned, I've noticed.
Yeah.
There's a lot of marketing gone into that.
Big marketing, big budget. Stephen Bartlett investing obviously really accelerated that. Obviously, Tim Spector, who's at King's as well, different department, obviously, he has, you know, done a very good job of marketing it. There is another huge debate about whether the everyday person who doesn't suffer with diabetes or is not pre-diabetic needs to monitor their blood glucose. And there's some really interesting research coming out of Oxford currently, which says that it can actually generate a huge amount of misinformation because it's a little bit too reductive in terms of the science of it. I won't go into the kind of huge details of that. But yeah, there's lots of conflicting things coming out about the Zoe. But I've got friends that swear by it and find it really useful.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Stop suffering with pet-related allergies when near dogs and cats. Great news, you can feel safe around pets with Nasal Guard for pet lovers. Nasal Guard topical gel blocks pet dander, hair, and dust mites from entering your nasal passages. Try Nasal Guard for pet lovers today. Visit Amazon or nasalguard.co.uk to learn more about Nasal Guard spray and gel products. Again, that's nasalguard.co.uk.
Apples and pears, beef and Skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Deck, fish and chips, Mum and Dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com. Strawberries and
cream. A cancer diagnosis can be scary and stressful for everyone involved. Hello Love is a contemporary living space and well-being center in central London where anyone can come and learn about illness prevention and non-toxic practice. Inside, you will find a vegan restaurant, juice bar, and holistic dojo that encourage lifestyle changes to help heal mind, body, and spirit connection. Cancer patients are offered free sessions. To find out more, please visit us at hellolove.org.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens, and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
The station that makes you feel good.
You mentioned conflicting information. It's hard to mention that without just going into the social media a little bit. So let's do that now, because actually a lot of these wearables do link into social media in various different ways. One way that I kind of know about, and this is linked to people exercising, you have leaderboards that are kind of publicly yes. accessible. So mm-hmm. you can kind of join up and compete with people all around the world in practically anything. I can't see that as terribly healthy. Or have you what's your experience of this kind of thing?
Yeah, so when I was doing my master's and PhD, which is a number of years ago now, that was really the big trend, was this kind of it's what also known as social fitness. So you have this interaction with a group of like-minded community online, you know, individuals that you might be competing with. I guess, yeah, it can be really motivating though. And I think it can be really fun to kind of share your route, share your experience, how you felt, what shoes you're wearing, you know, if you're running, say, for example, or whatever sport you're doing. I'm a runner, so I keep coming back to running. Sharing all of that information can be really kind of fun and exciting. And I think particularly during COVID, when we were all so isolated, it really boomed mm-hmm. again yeah. during that time when everyone obviously was stuck at home or able to get out for their one daily walk or run. And sharing your data, that the leaderboard thing really was a huge motivator for the showcasing of achievement and the kind of self-congratulation or admiration or motivation that you would get from your online community. I guess it could be damaging in the context of the sense of competition or the upward comparison that you might feel towards actual athletes, that you can see their data, because a lot of it is like visible, right? So people are kind of benchmarking themselves and going, oh, I can't run as fast as whoever who's like actually professionally, you know, an athlete in that specific like discipline or sport. So I guess in that respect, or it could just be very motivating. So I think the social fitness element is probably one of the things I'm least worried about. Right. But I think that the acquisition of data is forever a concern, because what it does is it equates physical activity to data, which is reductive and yeah. doesn't always represent health. You know, doing lots of running doesn't mean health, doing lots of steps doesn't mean health, good health. So I think that's where it can be a little bit oversimplified.
Sure. All right. When you said acquisition of data, I thought you were going down a slightly different route there, because I have actually asked some people that work for some of these companies that make and provide wearables, what happens to all the massive amount of data that you collect on people and where it goes, if anywhere, is it safe? Or do you even mm-hmm. let scientists look at it? Because potentially it's quite a useful source, I would have thought. So
absolutely.
Have you got involved in those kind of discussions?
Yeah, so when I meant acquisition of data in that context, I was talking about just the individual user acquiring all this data through their yeah, own device, yeah. But also acquisition of data on the monetizable kind of commodification of health scale. Like the amount of data we're generating is incredibly valuable, and there's this concept and practice now called digital phenotyping, whereby you can capture data from non-health related spaces. So this could be your browsing history on Google, Amazon, your phone data, your GPS tracking, your scrolling on social media, what you're watching on certain streaming services, or what you're listening to on, you know, what podcast you're listening to on different streaming services. And it basically aggregates all of this data and creates a profile for your health based upon what you're doing. And it's called a digital phenotype. So it's a way of trying to profile your health based on non-health data. So that's very interesting, because that's data that's not even collected about health being used for health purposes, mm-hmm. potentially. And then being sold on to marketers.
Anyone can collect that stuff, I think, can't they?
Pretty yeah, much. Absolutely. So yeah, and I think
Are health insurance companies using that today? Presumably they are.
I'm sure they are. Yeah, I think it's certainly in America, certainly in systems whereby, you know, you have to have health insurance, or, you know, hopefully you have health insurance. Hopefully you can. Obviously, in the UK, we have a different welfare system, or currently we do. probably not for long. And I think it concerns me when I think about the monetization and the capturing and the loss of privacy when it comes to personal data. And I think COVID contact tracing data is one that I'm particularly interested to hear. Where is that data going? Who's got it? Who's monetizing it? Who's, you know, what are they doing with that data? Because we all voluntarily, or most those of us that could, signed up for contact tracing. What's happened to that data? I would love to know.
Interesting. All right. So we're sort of asking more questions than answering here. But that's kind of in the world we're in at the moment to some extent. Let me ask you about one aspect of this, which I think links to information and what happens to it. There are quite a few symptom checking type apps. Now, these aren't wearables necessarily, but I do know some of these link into wearables now as well, so that the two things are going on. So you can type into an app your symptoms, and at the same time it'll take on board the information it's got from your wearable, which could be heart rate, you know, and all the rest of these sorts of things, how much movement you do, and all that is put together to then tell you potentially what the problem is if you've got some particular symptoms. Now, do you think those are going to become a big deal in the future, or maybe they're a big deal now? I don't know.
I think that they are. I really am very wary of these symptom trackers, checkers, or self-diagnostic tools, or even like the AI chatbots that people will kind of put in their symptoms to, and then the AI chatbot will just say cancer, or like, you know, it will kind of come up with something terrifying. I think they're already happening. I think there's a level of criticality with misinformation, and we kind of touched on this earlier briefly, around people being very wary about getting the wrong information. I don't think that everybody has that awareness, but I think COVID made everybody a little bit more, I called it like everybody becoming like a lay expert of like viral illnesses due to COVID. Like we all had to try and equip ourselves with as much information as possible. And of course, symptom trackers and stuff were all a part of that. I hope that there's a level of criticality with it and kind of taking it with a big pinch of salt. I think the government and increasing use of AI in public healthcare will push it more and more, because as you say, it's cost the government less and it's a cheaper alternative, and it means it might stop people trying to get to their GP if they can use a symptom tracker or checker. So yeah, it's a complex one. I'm very wary of them.
Okay, that'll be interesting, because I have come across some that actually seem quite accurate, you know, seem pretty good. So from a public health point of view, it might be quite good. And one aspect of them that I've come across is that they can potentially detect outbreaks quicker than all the information being collated from GPs and then going up to like a regional area and thinking, oh goodness, you know, there's an outbreak of measles or whatever it might be in this area. These sorts of outbreaks can potentially be spotted a lot quicker.
Yeah, that's great. That's very, very true. That's a very good point, actually. And I think that, as you say, because all of the NHS patient data and records being so localized and, you know, in the trust, and we don't have within the NHS, you know, a database that speaks between trusts, you know, it's quite archaic, the system and how it all works still. That, yeah, absolutely. In terms of identifying outbreaks, that could be really useful.
There's so many strands to this, isn't there? And just talking to you now, I'm thinking, oh goodness, I hadn't even thought about this aspect or that aspect. So we really are bombarded with health information, either kind of self-generated by us from wearables or just from everywhere else. I mean, you've got the marketing aspect of wearables, social media, which if you look at social media anytime, there's just health type information just being chucked at you all the time. On the tube, actually, I do this sometimes. If I look on the tube in London and look at the adverts, so you sit opposite a bank of adverts. I think there are 5 adverts usually.
The only adverts and I read, I think.
How many of those are some sort of health message? And it's often 2 or 3 out of 5.
Oh, yeah. It's a lot. And I think Londoners, we are saturated because, well, like, because we're so time poor, or maybe we were pre-pandemic. I don't know. I think the work-life balance has definitely shifted in a more positive way post-pandemic, or wherever we are now with it. But I do, generally, Londoners are pretty time poor, and therefore more health issues arise in that space, potentially. You know, more cash rich, time poor, therefore more scope to explore well-being advice and guidance.
Yeah. So, but what I'm leading up to is that, you know, when I was a kid, you would get public information films on the telly, and it might be how to cross the road, or it might be some sort of health type information. That is just kind of bombarded. It's just multiplied, or it's to the power of 10 now, you know, what happened before.
Yeah.
Is it just a wild west, or is there any kind of control being attempted? Can the government, should it be the government or the NHS, control this such that we do get sensible information, or is it kind of every man for themselves now? I mean, this almost seems like the basic question.
The fundamentals of what digital health is doing to us. And I completely agree that, I mean, I grew up with the 5-a-day campaign, and that was very normalised. And then you have that on food packaging, and that was the public health campaign of the time. And now the amount of information / misinformation / saturation of content and conflicting things from public health, from the digital world, from social media, from podcasts, you know, Diary of a CEO, you know, one of the biggest in the world, comes on every week with a different expert giving you different guidance and health advice. It's incredibly complicated and confusing and complex space to navigate now.
The Relax Back UK show kind of does the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much information out there that it's like, it's really hard. And health is so individualized, you know, to a certain degree, and so personalized. No, the government aren't doing enough. What I think is a good example of them actually doing well was in COVID on social media, the banners that popped up for any post that was about COVID, trying to reduce conspiracy theories and misinformation. So they managed to implement that on Instagram, for example. Anything that mentioned COVID, you get a little banner saying COVID, go to the NHS website.
That still happens, I think, doesn't it, to some extent?
I think it probably does, yeah. I mean, I think maybe people are so sick and they're not watching COVID content anymore. But yeah, it's... Yeah, I think it probably does. So why can't they do that for other forms of misinformation or anything else that kind of affects public health on that big scale? That's one of my problems with the lack of regulation of health content online. And I think that, you know, I will always go to NHS, WHO, WebMD, you know, kind of more reputable news sources. But my students and now the younger generation of social media users turn to influencers for health guidance. For 80% of them, they now look towards health and fitness influencers on social media, and largely Instagram and TikTok.
That is absolutely terrifying, isn't it?
Isn't it just? And this, I'm sure you probably touched maybe some of this on with Sophie Medlin, but also the amount, there's also some other terrifying statistics to come out of the University of Glasgow that Sophie told me about, actually, that was like nearly like, it was like 80% of the information that health and fitness influencers share on Instagram is incorrect as well. So you put those two statistics together and it is genuinely horrifying for health, the health of the younger generations. So the lack of regulation on the platforms where, and me and Sophie are actually writing a paper on this at the moment, we call it, you know, social media is like a new unregulated public health platform, because effectively that's where, you know, the younger generations are going for their health information. They're not going to the NHS, they're not going to the WHO. They're going to social media. And so it's just, so that in that respect, I think that is the Wild West. And it becomes, unfortunately, every man for himself because of the lack of intervention from government regulation.
Goodness me. All right. So after what you've just said, then, for anyone, whatever their age, if they're going online to find some sensible health information, where should they be going? I'm kind of hoping you're going to say the NHS website.
The NHS website, yeah, that's basically it, and the World Health Organization, and, you know, reputable, state-owned, not, you know, private company vested, interested, you know, institutions or companies. You know, I would avoid going to anyone, anything that is funded by a tech company or anybody with any stakeholder with a vested interest in health other than, you know, public health.
Okay. Very interesting. All right. Now, that to one side, if people have been listening to this and thinking, goodness, you know, I haven't really sort of thought about this stuff before, or I had thought about it, and frankly, I'm a bit worried or a bit horrified, and I'd like to learn some more, find out what Rachel is kind of studying and finding out about. You've got a couple of resources, don't you? You have a podcast as well.
I do. I have a podcast that is about tackling misinformation. So I think it's a good source for those that want to understand a little bit more about how tech affects your health, but also how misinformation is so rife and where you'll see it. So the podcast is called Digital Health Diagnosed, Your Dose of Tech Wellbeing. You can find it on YouTube, on Spotify, Apple, across all kind of main podcast streaming platforms. And we've also got TikTok and Instagram, and I'm posting regularly across LinkedIn as well. But really the goal of me setting up and doing the podcast was about the amount of misinformation out there and how can we kind of cut through that noise and say, right, this is happening. We can't stop it happening. But if we can have a conversation about it and educate people on how to live better with technology, then that might make a difference, however small.
And also how to spot it, presumably.
Exactly. How to identify the misinformation and the stuff that might be potentially harmful for your health, mental or physical.
Okay. Now, along the same lines, you've also got a book out. I love to let my guests talk about books and things that they've written. And I know you've written a book, so please do mention
that. I have. Yeah, so my book is called The Digital Health Self, and this is literally the culmination of about 17 years worth of research, and it's tracing kind of historically what's happened in the digital health landscape, but again, it's really identifying how we live today with technology as an extension of self and the body, talking about technology addiction, the moralization of health, the saturation of content, surveillance, data mining, AI. I cover so much stuff in that book, and it's been my absolute baby for such a long time, and I'm so happy that it's now out in the world. It was published last May by Bristol University Press, and I'm incredibly proud of it, and I think a really useful resource for those working in the tech space, health space, as well as academics, and those just generally interested in healthcare today, because I very much talk about how health intersects with tech, but in everyday life.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, congratulations on the book. Thank you very much for talking about this, which is fascinating, interesting, terrifying, all these things rolled into one. And you know, and very important as well, because, you know, it ain't going anywhere. This is now the world we live in. So, Rachel Kent, many, many thanks for chatting.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've loved our conversation. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Dr. Rachel Kent for being such a wonderful guest. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Start your day the right way with Revive Active's range of super supplements and get the most out of life. Take one power-packed sachet, mix with water, and enjoy a super tasty health drink at work, at home, or on the go. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to optimize your health and well-being to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, and more. No filler, no stimulants, no artificial colours or preservatives, just the right mix of vitamins, minerals, amino acids and hero ingredients to help you put back what life takes out. Try our 7-day or 30-day boxes and use code UKRADIO to get a free supplement shaker. Revive Active. Super supplements for a super you.
Nature's Medicine for Modern Living, a people and plants dialogue hosted by Sophie.Health. At Sophie, we bring together experts and voices who rarely cross paths. Our quest is to illuminate the ancient world of plant medicine and reimagine it for the connected age. Join us to explore new boundaries of digital personalized medicine with deep roots in the natural world and hear from our community of international pioneers who are validating this new paradigm and improving how we feel, sleep, and cope with daily stresses naturally. Sophie.health, reconnecting people and plants.
Once upon a time, human slavery was just a fact of life. Right now, animal abuse is often considered normal. In time, it won't be. Animal Aid campaigns peacefully against all forms of animal abuse and promotes cruelty-free living.
Check out animalaid.org.uk. It's time for a kinder world.
The station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.